From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, Questlove, the drummer for The Roots, one of the few hip-hop bands that actually plays instruments instead of just sampling music. As a child, he spent a lot of time backstage at doo-wop revival shows with his father, Lee Andrews. The Roots have a new album called Phrenology. It was on Spin Magazine's list of the best CDs of 2002. The band starts a national tour today. Also, we talk with comedian David Cross. He was the co-creator and co-star of the HBO sketch comedy series Mr. Show. He's just released his first CD, a live recording from his stand-up tour. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. In the world of hip-hop, where most music is sampled, the Roots are exceptional. They play instruments. My guest Questlove is the band's co-founder and drummer. Spin Magazine included their latest CD, Phrenology, on its list of the best albums of 2002. In GQ, rock critic Tom Moon wrote, "The Roots have never been hitmakers. Their vision for black music tears out in radical directions, encompassing jazz, trance, rock, and Brazilian pop." From the beginning, this group of jazz heads and rhyme warriors have done things differently. They're a band, for starters, working in a genre in which musicians were once thought irrelevant. Their orbit has included activist rappers and rock stars, anyone grappling with what it means to be black and alternative. Questlove, who is also known as Amir Thompson, grew up around music. His father, Lee Andrews, led the doo-wop group Lee Andrews and the Hearts, which had the hit Teardrops. Questlove co-founded The Roots in 1987 when he was a student at the Philadelphia High School for Creative and Performing Arts. The Roots begin a national tour today. Let's start with a track from their latest CD, Phrenology. This is The Seed 2.0 with guest vocalist Cody Chestnut.
Knocked up 9 months ago, and what she finna have, she don't know. She want neo soul, cause hip hop is old. She don't want no rock and roll. She want platinum or ice and gold. She want a whole lot of sun to fold. If you were obstacles, you just drop your cold. Cause one monkey don't stop the show. Little Mary's bad. In these streets, she done ran ever since when the heat began. I told a girl, look here, calm down, I'ma hold your hand to enable you to peep the plan. Cause you was quick to learn, and we can make money to burn. If you allow me to lay this game, I don't ask for much, but enough room to spread my wings. And the world finna know my name.
I don't ask these days, and I don't bitch and whine if I don't get my way. I only wanna fertilize another behind my lover's back. I sit and watch it to roots stand where I'm at. Fertilize another behind my lover's back, and I'm keeping my secrets.
Music from The Roots' new CD, Phrenology, and my guest is Questlove of The Roots. Welcome to Fresh Air.
Now, thanks for having me.
One thing everybody who knows The Roots knows about The Roots is that you play your own instruments. You're a drummer.
Right.
How unusual is that in hip-hop?
To be honest with you, my manager, Richard Nichols, and I were actually reflecting on kind of how sad it is that... He told me that, man, if Ellington were alive today, he'd be turning over. He'd just turn over in his grave for the fact that actual musicianship is used as a novelty or a selling point to get a group over. And it's nothing that I think of is quite unusual. And technically, because of sampling laws and a lot of restrictions that are placed on hip-hop right now, there are a lot of people that are utilizing, instruments in their work. And even the early work of hip-hop before technology sort of, caught up with modern times, you pretty much had to play a popular breakbeat to the house band. On Sugar Hill Records, Grandmaster Flash would have to play a particular breakbeat or cut to a house band, and they would have to sort of emulate it as if he were on the turntables. So, it is unusual. I will say that we are probably one of the more popular bands. Hip-hop that utilizes live instrumentation is just like musicians for hire, whereas, the Roots are the actual focal point of, to the viewer, so to speak.
When you started playing drums, as somebody who already loved rap, and this was like in the 80s, did you think there'd be a place for you in rap or hip-hop?
See, yeah, I kind of thought it was natural. You have to understand that when I was coming up, the first rap records that were out were records that were played by musicians. So you had Doug Wimbush, bassist Doug Wimbush, who plays for Living Color right now, and Keith LeBlanc, who's a popular drummer in his own right. They were the, I guess, the Sly and Robbie of Sugar Hill Records. And then the Sugar Hill's the rival, Enjoy Records, the label that had the Treacherous Three and Spoonie G, they were backed up by a percussionist named Pumpkin, because he was the band leader and, I guess, a drummer. And the nucleus of his ensemble, a lot of the breaks that he performed, it just spoke to me. So I just thought it was a natural thing. And coming up in high school, when the Roots first started, you know, hip-hop really wasn't that elaborate an arrangement. I'm talking about hip-hop circa 1984, 85, 86. I mean, it's pretty much just a drum beat, a simple drum beat, and a stab. A stab would be sort of like the exclamation point at the end of a sentence. Bam! You know, it could be scratched in or just like some sort of noise, mm-hmm. an enforcement noise. And, you know, so in high school, pretty much Black Thought, Tariq Trotter, would, you know, come up to me and just name any popular song at that time and point and just say, yo, play Top Billing. And, you know, because it was a drum arrangement, I knew how to play it. And that was like the most amazing thing to him. That, oh, he could play Top Billing. He could play, you know, The Bridge Is Over. He could play, you know, just naming all these songs and I could play them. I kind of thought it was natural.
Okay, well, I'm going to stop you right there, because that's kind of interesting. Since you came up in the era of sampling, as an actual musician, your friends mm-hmm. expected you to basically play the samples. You're still expected
to
play, but you're still expected to play like other people's music.
Right. Well, I mean, that's hip hop is audio pop art, really. It's just a collage of other ideas. And even at the time, I didn't know that, okay, sampling is the proper term for it. For the hip hop nation, pretty much the first introduction to real sampling that we've ever seen was this episode of The Cosby Show when Stevie Wonder runs over the Huxtables' car with his limousine. Well, not that violent, but, you know, he invites them to a studio session. And for the first time, America got to see the process of sampling, in which you say something and it's repeated back to you. And after me and my friend saw that episode, we were begging for whatever that machine was called. We didn't know what it was called. You know, like in our heads, it was sort of like the Flintstone episode where, you know, like the little bird is inside of the machine and recreating the noise. And we didn't know how in the world that happened. So just during Christmas, Casio happened to make a product called an SK1 machine, which allowed you about maybe 3 or 4 seconds worth of sampling time. And, you know, me and all my friends got this little toy keyboard for Christmas. And, you know, you mess around with it a little while. You do all, like all the curse words, you know, and all that stuff. And then you start getting serious about it. And that's when I would like run to the basement where my drum set was and try and cram in 8 bars worth of drum breaks within 3 seconds, which, you know, you have to be pretty fast to do it.
Right.
And then I just, you know, realized the endless possibilities of a sampler.
Well, while we're talking about musicianship and sampling, I thought this would be a good time to play Rock You from your new CD, Phrenology, because you're actually playing on this, but you're playing more or less a rhythm line from Queen's We Will Rock You. But again, you're not sampling
it.
You're playing it,
yeah,
and you're reinterpreting it, too.
It's inspired by it, but some artists are a little iffy about sample clearances, so...
Got it. Anything else you want to say about Rock You?
In case
you
the Lords are listening.
Right. Anything else you want to say about Rock You?
Rock You is just our mission statement. You know, the Roots are so associated with just a mellow atmosphere. I thought it was real important to start off the album with an exclamation point, you know. So Rock You is our mission statement for the album.
Okay. That's your
Okay.
Rock me, 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 r get y'all niggas in a real strange way. Schmucks, ducks, and half-hearted pranks to cruise. Willie Dack, Langston Hughes, put shanks and crews. I debut to make the news, and I've been killing it since. Still in the trench, buzzing off the chiller suspense. I want my niggas out that barbed wire, still in the fence. Verbal assassin, I'm a killer, still in the sense. Rhymes is graphic, aiming straight at your minds, and blast that weak. The pieces and particles of fragments, mad vocabulary. Yes, I must confess, I'm like Nitty trying to sink a slug in Elliot's chest. Just taste on that, it's black, you can tell it.
That's The Roots from their new CD, Phrenology. My guest is Questlove, the drummer of the group, and one of the founders. The word niggas is used on the track that we just heard. When is it okay with you, and when is it not okay with you to use the word?
You know, I could play the politically correct term and say, you know, well, okay, we know it's wrong, but I mean, but basically, I think with black people, we pretty much will turn any tragedy into a term of endearment. So, you know, is it right? You know, I don't know if it's right or if it's wrong. You know, personally, I don't think that black people haven't made up that term, but I think that we've turned it around and it's just another, I guess, like colloquialism for brother. To us, you know,
mm-hmm.
What's up, my nigga? How you doing? You know,
did you grow up with it that way?
Pretty much. I mean, it was natural. I mean, there, you know, the difference between if you're being referred to as, you know, my brother, or if it's using a condescending term,
mm-hmm.
You know.
My guest is Questlove, the co-founder and drummer of the hip-hop band The Roots. Their latest CD is called Phrenology. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Questlove, the co-founder and drummer of the hip-hop band The Roots. Their latest CD is called Phrenology. You started playing drums when you were in high school, yes?
No, actually
earlier
I started when I was two.
Oh, okay.
I was 2 years old. I started The Roots when I was in high school. My father is an oldies doo-wop singer from the Philadelphia area.
Leandrews of Leandrews and the Hearts.
Yeah, Leandrews and the Hearts. So I pretty much, my childhood is... It's pretty much based just backstage at doo-wop extravaganza shows, you know, like Dick Clark Presents, you know, and there'd be like 10 groups, Don and Wine, Harvey and the Moonglows, The Tokens, you name it. If they were from the 50s or the 60s, it would just be a big show at either like Madison Square Garden or the Spectrum or out in the Forum in L.A., so pretty much I grew up backstage
now,
watching all these groups.
Leandro's biggest hit, I think, was Teardrops in 1957.
Teardrops.
Yeah,
57. Yeah, 57.
Would you be willing to sing a few lines from it just to refresh listeners' memories?
I wouldn't want to scare your listeners, so.
Okay, well, how about this? How about we play a little bit of it?
We can do that, yeah.
I sit in my room, looking out at the rain. My tears are like crystals, they cover my window pane. I'm thinking of our lost romance and how it should have been. Oh, if we only could start over again. Out on you, I was wrong to take a chance with somebody new. I sit in my room, looking out at the rain. My tears are like crystals, they cover my window pane. I know you never.
Okay, so that's Leandra's and the Hearts. So you grew up, you know, backstage and watching your father perform. What sense did it give you of what the music life was like? And then you probably watched your father kind of drop out of sight after the doo-wop era was over. So you also knew what it was like to no longer be in the limelight after having been in it as a young man.
I mean, I was born in the 70s, so pretty much I came along.
Oh, you came along in the
It really wasn't about it. I mean, even though he made it a career, if anything, he taught me that there is a plan B, you know, and that not everyone gets the plan A limelight.
Right. What was his
By the time I was born, you know, he had met and married my mother. I have a sister as well, and they had opened up a boutique store. And they were quite content. And, you know, as with any music phenomenon that occurs 20 years before, there's an upsurgence of it 20 years later. And I guess most of that started when Sha-Na-Na appearing at Woodstock, and then pretty much after that, just Dick Clark would throw a slew of shows just in the tri-state area, in the New York area, any place that loved doo-wop. Mm-hmm. And my father just made a great living out of it. And
don't you often wonder if there's going to be, like, old-school rap shows? Like,
oh, there is right now.
Is there already?
Totally. And the thing with hip-hop is the motto for hip-hop is definitely here today and gone today. So
yeah, I know what you mean.
Anything under 5 years is pretty much considered old school. This weekend, I was listening to a popular New York radio station, and they were like, "Now, back in the day, Wu-Tang Clan, da-da-da-da, old school." I was like, "Wait a minute, Wu-Tang? That's 6 years ago."
Right.
It's like 6-7 years ago. You know, old school to me is, okay, maybe we can say, like, Marvin Gaye's Let's Get It On, like a song that's definitely over 20 years old or something, you know, near 30 years old. But, yeah, pretty much in the hip-hop, it's here today and it's gone today.
Let's get back to your high school years. And you went to the High School of Creative and Performing Arts.
Performing Arts, right.
In Philadelphia.
Yes.
And so that means that you were exposed at a young age to artists of your age, of every sort.
Exactly.
You know, painters and dancers and people in theater,
everything,
and music of
Boys
every
to
sort.
Boys to Men rehearsing in the...
Boys to Men was in your school?
In the bathroom,
mm-hmm.
Always rehearsing.
Was it good to be exposed to so much?
It was perfect. You know, like, unfortunately, I came to Performing Arts High School in the 11th grade. I started, Performing Arts had a private school sector that I went to from first to eighth grade. Then my parents took me out of that school and tried to send me to a college prep school, which was good academic. You know, I could wind up on Jeopardy, you know, you know, talk about the Iliad or something. But, you know, my heart was with music development. And so I begged them to send me to the public school for performing arts, and finally got my wish for the 11th and 12th grade. And walking there, like, I'd never been to public school, and pretty much my only exposure to that type of school was watching the television show Fame.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, you're kind of wondering, like, okay, is this the type of school that's going to be, like, a cliche? Like, are they going to break out and dance numbers in the hallway and you know, do all the things that you see on television. And, you know, I was, like, real skeptical of it. Like, it's not going to be, like, Fame or whatever. And sure enough, like, you walk into class and, you know, they're singing, you know, Boyz II Men's practicing in the corner. And you have, like, Christian McBride and Joey DeFrancesco trading fours down the hallway.
Wait, these are now well-known jazz musicians.
Exactly. Yeah. Like, you know, like, the who's who of, like, the thespian world rehearsing, you know, their sonnets over there, and it's crazy. It was really a weird experience for me.
Now, like, street credibility and authenticity is so important in rap, and, you know, A lot of people believe that to be a good rap group or hip hop group, you have to like be from the ghetto. You have to be gangsters, the streets.
Right.
Yeah. And so here you are. You know, you didn't go to the prep school. You went to the High School of Creative and Performing Arts. So was this? Did you ever see this as like an obstacle to doing what you wanted to do? Because you might not be perceived to have the street cred.
Well, the Roots are also made up of six other people. I just happen to be the mouthpiece of the Roots.
So it's okay that you don't have street
cred. But my credibility comes in the fact that when it comes to music. You have to have a vast vocabulary of musical knowledge, at least for me. I mean, now pretty much hip hop is, and it's just at water stage, which is you know, just turn on a beat machine. You know, you have a lot of producers saying with great pride and alacrity, like, oh, you know, I made this beat in 3 minutes, you know, which I'm like, wow, okay. Whereas I think that for me, a requirement for a good producer in hip hop is one that has to have a vast knowledge of musical substance. You know, just the cats that I look up to, they collect records, they know certain musicians, there's a vast vocabulary that you have to know.
Questlove is the co-founder and drummer of the hip-hop band The Roots. Their latest CD is called Phrenology. He'll be back in the second half of the show. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and Anchor Books, publishers of the paperback novel Balzac and the Little Chinese Seamstress by Dai Siji. This is NPR, National Public Radio. Coming up, drummer Questlove of The Roots reveals his five paths a young black male can take to success in life and entertainment, including what he describes as the Mandingo Factor. And we talk with David Cross, co-creator and co-star of the former HBO sketch comedy series Mr. Show. He has a new live CD of his stand-up tour. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with Questlove, the co-founder and drummer of the hip-hop band The Roots. They begin a national tour today. Their latest CD is called Phrenology. After it was released, a review in Details magazine said, hip-hop's best live band may have just served notice that they're hip-hop's best band, period. I asked if it bothers him when people think the most important thing in hip-hop is street credibility rather than musical ability.
Well, that becomes a problem in hip hop because pretty much, well, in life or in entertainment in general, there's only five routes that one's allowed to take, at least as a young black male, that one is allowed to take in order to achieve any type of success. Number one, obviously, is the over the top the vicarious fantasy gangster image that people are in love with. Number two is the Mandingo factor, that I like to say, the Mandingo factor, which sort of reinforces the sexual stud, overtly sexual stereotype. Number three is the, I guess, the over-the-top personality. I really want to, go there and say coon, but that's a little too harsh.
Mm-hmm.
But it's just that an over-the-top, an over-the-top personality. Number four is the sugar pop, sort of diluted, apolitical, ambiguous area. And number five, unfortunately, is the one I try and walk on, but it doesn't seem to work. The art for art's sake route, which is pretty much a neutral ground. And that becomes a problem because it forces people to actually have to really focus on the character and figure out what they are, you know. I mean, the roots aren't gangster, the roots aren't political, the roots aren't overtly sexual, the roots aren't clowns, the roots aren't easily categorized. And as a result, you know, it's just a slow, slow journey to, it's sort of like the tortoise and the hare, it's just a slower journey to the finish line.
Well,
but you eventually get there.
The Art for Art's Sake group isn't usually the group with the biggest commercial success.
Yeah, it doesn't seem that interesting, you know. But you get a lot of people that, oh, you know, what type of microphones do you, you know, like a lot of Art for Art's Sake questions, you know, which I don't necessarily mind. But sometimes it does get frustrating, mm-hmm. that, you know, because you're not filling for or fulfilling a particular requirement for people.
Mm-hmm. Now, the roots are from Philly, and for a lot of rappers, like the place they're from becomes like mythologized through their raps.
Right.
What do you think you've done, like, to create a Philadelphia in your music?
Well, Philadelphia had sort of a bad / nondescript reputation. Between
in hip hop, you mean? Because there was the Philly sound before that. That
yeah, I'm just talking in terms of hip hop.
Mm-hmm,
even
right.
though, I'll say two of the major important factors of hip hop history have originated in Philadelphia. Number one, gangster rap. Pretty much, there's debate as to whether Ice-T, L.A., who's from L.A. or Schoolie D, who's from 52nd and Parkside, was the first quote-unquote gangster rapper. And pretty much anybody that's familiar with Schoolie D can give you pretty much an account of where they were the first time they ever heard his classic, PSK, What Does It Mean? You know, because we just never heard a rap that explicit. You know, pretty much hip-hop before then was about partying. And, you know, there were some reality rhymes here and there. You know, the message by Grandmaster Flash and Maybe It's Like mm-hmm. That by Run DMC. But, you know, pretty much everyone's been, like, politically correct. You didn't hear that much profanity, that much cursing, and that much honesty. You know, Schoolie D talked like your older cousin on the corner, you know, or the guys that you knew down the street on the corner. And, you know, he was very influential to a lot of
right.
of people, the Beastie Boys, and the list goes on.
So what's
and
your
also,
yeah what's your image of Philly in your music?
Well we had to take that, and well, let me just quickly say that the other important element was the art of DJing. Philadelphia has four very important pioneers in DJing. Jazzy Jeff, DJ Cash Money, DJ Miz, and DJ Cheese, all from the tri-state area, and they're pretty much the standard for which DJs today are basing their skills on. When you talk about DJs doing the look mono hand tricks and whatnot. So pretty much that's all that Philly, those were the two major factors that Philly offered in the 80s. And, you know, living under New York's shadow didn't help matters much because, you know, they were the creme de la creme of right. culture.
So what's the picture of Philly that you think your music gives in the stories that it tells?
Right now, I guess the sound of Philly is the sound of a term that they've coined called neo-soul,
mm-hmm.
which is pretty much a musical backdrop of lush arrangements, Fender Rhodes, like lush, jazzy 70s jazz arrangements, the same instruments that a Roy Ayers would use, Fender Rhodes and upright bass, lush strings, you know, keeping the strings from the original Philadelphia sound. The drums are just a little more quote-unquote crunk, meaning more street. So basically it's like street drums over a lush arrangement, sort of the contrast there. And that's the sound, pretty much the sound of Philadelphia. That's the sound of Jill Scott. That's the sound of music. That's the sound that we were a part of developing. Of course, Phrenology is the exact opposite of that sound because we didn't want to get typecast into just one particular sound.
Mm-hmm. One last thing. I'm interested in your record collection.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I understand you have a really big one. What's the range of things that you listen to?
Anything. I'm just into anything musical, you know. I like the incredible Bongo Rock group. I like David Bowie. I like, you know, I collect a lot of rare hip hop records, and I collect just a lot of obscure records that have been used in samples. I'm very curious in the ingredients that other producers have used to make their records. You know, it's sort of like someone going out and buying a cookbook to see the ingredients that went
right.
inside of a
right.
particular stew. So I collect those type of things.
Do you collect a lot of vinyl?
Yeah, I'm about 27,000 strong right now.
A vinyl?
I know that's not messing with DJ Shadow's collection. I heard he's up to 60,000.
Wow. So, it's mighty impressive, though.
I got some ways to go, but I'll get there.
Okay, and one final question.
Yes.
How come you wear an afro?
Because I'm secretly a Chia Pet.
I won't sing the theme.
right.
Yeah.
My hair just grows. I come from a family that, you know, I don't have the patience nor the time to go to a barbershop and get it cut every 3 seconds. So my hair just grows. It's always been problematic for me. Just thank God it's in style now. Imagine me trying to get through this hairstyle in the late 80s and the early 90s, you know. Back then I could do a flat top thing, but I keep it. It's my crown, you know. It's sort of symbolic now, but it was a problem back in the day. You know, people staring at me like, "Oh my God!" You know, now it's no thing because everyone has it.
Oh, besides you're you, so
yeah, exactly.
You can do it now.
I'm an individual.
That's right. Thank
or
you
one
so
of the
much,
Missing Jacksons.
Oh, thank
All right, thank you.
Thanks so much for talking with us.
Thank you. I appreciate it, Tara.
Questlove is the drummer and co-founder of the hip-hop band The Roots. Their latest CD is called Phrenology. The band starts a national tour today.
Roots featuring Tommy Tommy doing the new jam from the Phrenology LP entitled Rolling With Heat. It's the top of the hour. We're about to prepare you for another 2 hours of music-free commercials.
But hey, it's the stroke of midnight, and you know what that means. It's the Manny Unk Malt Liquor sponsored Shibuya Roll Call Hour, giving out respect and love to the architects who designed this culture.
Grandmaster Flash and the Furious Five.
Coming up, comic David Cross, co-host of the former HBO sketch comedy series Mr. Show. This is Fresh Air. Comic David Cross has his first CD recorded live on his stand-up comedy tour last spring and summer. I can't really say the title on the radio, so let's just call it Shut Up, You Expletive Baby. Cross is best known as the co-founder and co-star with Bob Odenkirk of the former HBO sketch comedy series Mr. Show. The first and second seasons are collected on DVD. Newsweek called Cross and Odenkirk the goofball gurus of the alternative comedy movement. On the other hand, an article in the Washington Post described the two as sharing an acidic intellectual approach to humor. Cross started doing stand-up in 1982. He's appeared in several films and TV series, including Ghost World, Men in Black, Waiting for Guffman, Just Shoot Me, and The Drew Carey Show. Before we meet him, here's an excerpt of his new CD, in which he's talking about growing up Jewish in a suburb of Atlanta, Georgia.
All the parents see you as is Jew. I'm a Jewish kid. I'm like a f***ing alien to them, you know. I'm a freak, and I'm in their living room, you know, and f***ing Dunwoody. What's happening? So, like, if I slept over a friend's house, and I'd always have to deal with these questions in the morning, like, you know, mom coming and going, David, I'm so sorry to have to ask you this. I'm so sorry. I'm fixing to make breakfast for everybody, and I certainly won't include you. And I don't know. I'm just having some questions I was hoping you could answer. Do y'all's people eat oatmeal? You know? What? Yeah. Is there something in the Torah that says we shouldn't eat oatmeal? What are you talking about? Why wouldn't we eat oatmeal? What? I don't know much about y'all's peoples. That's all. I just don't know. I know y'all hate Jesus. That much I do know. And I know y'all have 7 Jew bankers that control the world's money supply, right? In a bunker somewhere about a mile into the Earth's core. Is that right? Yeah. And y'all do, like, dances in the woods. Y'all wear cloaks and do secret services and burn potions and whatnots. And y'all have horns. Right? That's all I know about y'all's people. Yeah.
David Cross does a lot of religious, political, and sexual humor. Now that he's pretty well known, he feels like he's often preaching to the converted. But sometimes he has a date where the audience is unprepared for what they're about to hear. And he doesn't mind.
Well, I did one show fairly recently. And I got picked up by 2 of the students, and they were driving me to the college or the university, and I said, so tell me a little bit about the school. And they go, well, you know, it was founded in 18 whatever, and it's a Jesuit school. And I was like, what? Yeah, it's a Jesuit school. And then I said, well, have you guys seen my act? No, but, you know, we saw you did Just Shoot Me, and you were in Men in Black. That was pretty funny. And so then I was like, all right, fine. And I went up there and had 300 walkouts. And,
wow. That's more than are in many audiences.
Yeah, it was pretty impressive.
Now, you describe yourself as an atheist, Jewish born. Mm-hmm. And as you describe in the CD, once you're born Jewish, you kind of stay Jewish even if you are an atheist, because that's the rules of the game.
Right. Yes.
So how did you become an atheist?
I was about 10 years old. I know I'd just moved back to Georgia, and I was about 10 years old, and I was in a synagogue one day, and it just kind of, it didn't, like, just hit me, but I just got a very strong, almost spiritual, if you will, feeling of this is wrong, this is garbage. This is obvious, and it's obvious in the ways that this is superstition, and this is, you know, and I didn't have it formulated at the age of 10, but I just had that feeling. And then I went through a little phase where I felt very guilty about it, because that's one of the things that Judaism does very well, is it will guilt you into staying in the fold, you know. They're very good at, you know, making you feel very terrible about turning your back on the faith. And I went through this phase where I tried to, I went to a stricter synagogue for about half a year, and
why'd you do that?
Because I felt guilty about it. I really tried hard to find some faith, and I was thinking about being a rabbi, you know, and then, you know, I got bar mitzvahed, and then I woke up from that and said, this is just not true to what I really believe, and I'm not being true to myself, and I think this is nonsense, and I think all religion is, you know, based on historical fallacy, and I understand why it exists, and especially when you look at the history of Catholicism, that's a particularly gross and terrible, you know, mean-spirited.
This would be a good time to give our email address. But let me ask you this: Do you ever consider that that religion might be, you know, a beautiful metaphor to guide you through life and to help you find a place for yourself in the world?
Sure, but I will counter that, and I will agree with you. But I'll counter that by saying, I have not needed it. I do not need a Bible or a Torah or anything of that nature to tell me what is right and what is wrong.
So you grew up Jewish before becoming an atheist in Georgia. You grew up in a suburb mm-hmm. of Atlanta. Were there a lot of, like, stereotypes or misconceptions about Judaism that you were exposed to?
Oh, sure. Maybe not stereotypes that I saw in particular, because we were poor too, which was also strange for people to grasp their, you know, heads around, the idea that, wait, I thought you people hoarded money, but we were on welfare and we were living in this dumpy apartment and, you know, on Medicare, and my dad had left. So, you know, here's some Jews that aren't hoarding, not controlling the media and hoarding money. And I don't know what to think, but they still found it in their heart to spit on us and beat us up on occasion. So that was all right. Which happened a number of times. I got confronted with anti-Semitism quite a bit.
Were you considered a nerd in high school?
Yes, very much so. Very much so. I mean, you know, I had kind of that Jufro glasses at an early age. I read, you know, things like that.
What did you read?
You know, books, novels. I remember getting in trouble for Mrs. Allen, my English teacher in seventh grade. I didn't go out to the field for PE, and I sat in the class, which you're not supposed to do. I could have gone out there. I don't know what made me sit in the class. I think I was at the very end of Gone with the Wind, and I was reading it, and I just wanted to finish it before I went out there. And she came back in the room, and I was sitting way in the back, and just sitting there reading with my head in a book, and she accused me of being up to something, and then the way she substantiated that was by saying, there's no way I would be reading Gone with the Wind. And that's a true story.
I think you got started doing comedy in Boston after dropping out of Emerson College. Why did you drop out, and what were your early routines like after you did?
Well, I actually started in Atlanta. I started just before high school ended, and did open mic nights there for a little while, and I took a year off before I went to college, and I had just started to get like $50 here and there to MC a show and host a show, and then I went up to Emerson in Boston and kind of stopped for a while, but I did a sketch group in college and then dropped out of Emerson pretty quickly, and I just started doing stand-up and continuing to perform in these little underground comedy groups here and there. And I think, you know, I've evolved quite a bit, not necessarily for the better, but my act has evolved from more of a kind of dry, more esoteric type of humor, and a lot of stuff where I would go up as a fake character. Like, I'd go up as a really nervous, very effeminate, gay, shaky guy who was trying comedy for his first time, and then I'd twist it at the end, or I'd go up as a retarded person, or just do these different characters where it would work, and I'd make the audience uncomfortable because they didn't know who I was, and they didn't know what to expect, and I'd always push that as far as I could. And then I started getting more personal pretty quickly, telling personal stories, and, you know, would go up there with my notepad and talk about stuff that just happened to me, and it kind of evolved into where I am now. And I can't, unfortunately, I can't do fake characters. I can't go up on stage as...
Because we'll recognize you.
Yeah, especially if you're there to see me, you know.
Ooh, obviously, right. Right.
Doesn't matter if I slap a wig on, it's people still know it's me, and so you lose that quality.
My guest is David Cross. He has a new live comedy CD. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is David Cross, the former host and the co-founder of the former HBO comedy series Mr. Show. He has a new live comedy CD. I'd love to hear more about the characters who you would do without people realizing that you were in character and not being yourself.
Well, as I said, one of them that I used to love was I'd go up as a guy named Daniel James Napoleon, and it was my first time, and I would do this... thing about this joke about my two dogs. It was really, you know, and I dressed the part, and I'd be a little nervous. This is my first time, and anywho, I have two adorable Pekingese and sprinkles and pepper, and then I would just tell this very unfunny joke about them watching TV, and they saw a commercial with a dog on it. They thought the dog was real, and then nobody would laugh, and then I'd just kind of fumble around. I'd do something where they could, or I'd get them to laugh, and then I'd say, I don't know if you're laughing with me or laughing at me, and then I'd say that they're all laughing at me, and then I would go, tell them that they're cruel, they're mean, and people really bum out. And I go, what do you want, some macho thing? Is that it? This is in the era of Andrew Dice Clay, by the way. I should have prefaced that. Is that it? Do you want macho? Is that strong men talking about men jokes? Is that it? And then I turn around, and then I can't say it on the air, but, you know, do some really, really crude Andrew Dice Clay thing. It was really nasty, like over the top, not funny, mean, nasty, sexist, awful humor. And then they'd laugh. And then, I'd go up occasionally as a retarded guy, a special guy, and have the host walk me up, and I would just barely be able to get anything out and really make people uncomfortable, and then I'd freak out at the end, and, those are two of my favorites.
It almost sounds like an Andy Kaufman type of thing.
It was. I really ripped off a lot of his ideas at that point and at that stage in my career, and really was enamored and in awe of him and what he did and how he expanded the definition of what stand-up comedy is and could be. And I used to go up as a really angry Southerner guy too, who'd talk about really upset with the comics that came prior to me. You know, the language, the making fun of the Bible, and then just start slowly getting more and more kind of crazy in that Art Bell conspiracy way. And that was a fun one to do.
So where's the joy in totally confusing the audience and getting them to think that that you're a terribly unfunny comic?
Well, I mean, it's all right there. You're absolutely completely in control of them, and they don't even know it. It's a really powerful, fun thing to do. I mean, they don't know that I'm faking it, but I do, and they're all like, I'm completely controlling the entire time I'm on stage, the set, whether I do well, whether I'm perceived as doing well or poorly. And then I'm also, part of the joy is that I'm doing something that clearly is not like any of the acts you've seen so far, you know. And I would especially love that when I'd go out to L.A. and do these showcases where you just get the worst comics cultivating their best/worst 5 minutes, and it's just garbage, and they're just pandering, and they're trying to get a sitcom, and you know, and then I'd go up there and I'd pretend that I have throat cancer, you know,
oh,
and I'm trying to do these impressions that I was an impressionist, and I do impressions, but I have throat cancer, so I have one of those, you know,
those things,
you know, those things that make you talk like that, and you know, you just get to watch the audience go, oh my God, what is this guy? Why'd they put him on? I was so enjoying the gentleman who, you know, made fun of Tarzan, you know, and then you kind of flip it on him. But again, it doesn't translate to work.
Right.
I've always been a comedian, a comic, but I didn't really get a lot of work out of it.
David Cross, his new live comedy CD, whose full title I can't say on the radio, is called Shut Up, You Expletive Baby. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. I'm Terry Gross.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and by Bantam Trade Paperbacks, a division of Random House, publisher of Ancient Herbs Modern Medicine, improving your health by combining Chinese herbal medicine and Western medicine, by Henry Han, OMD, Glenn Miller, MD, and Nancy DeVille. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, Bluffing, Cheating, and Gambling, we feature an interview with Andy Bellin, author of Poker Nation, which has just come out in paperback. He dropped out of grad school to play semi-pro poker. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air.